Stand, please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated. Case number 09-4268, United States of America versus Franklin H. Pettiford. The state is for the appellant and the motion for the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Mary Davis. I am representing the appellant, Mr. Pettiford. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for a rebuttal. There's a single issue on appeal, and that is whether the district court erred when it denied Mr. Pettiford's motion for new trial based on a Brady violation. The government has conceded that two of the components of the Brady violation have been satisfied. That is, first, that the evidence was favorable to Mr. Pettiford, and second, that it had been suppressed and not turned over. The only issue in dispute is whether the evidence was material. Now, the district court judge stated that it was material, but then, despite making that finding, said that Mr. Pettiford was not entitled to a new trial. Because
well, he used that word. I don't know that he made that finding.
Well,
in context, he clearly meant that it was relevant and went on to analyze it.
Right. And the analysis, though, when he went on to let me back up. I think he went beyond saying it was relevant. He said that it was one of the more serious issues he had seen of Brady evidence that could have affected the outcome of the trial. He said that the government certainly needed the 404B evidence to make its case because otherwise it couldn't prove knowing knowledge and intent. So I think the judge was saying more than it was relevant. I think he was saying it was material. But then the judge went on and looked.
It was material in the sense that you're suggesting. That would be the end of the matter, and he would have stopped at that point, right?
No, because I think what the judge then did is, instead of looking at how the evidence could have affected the previous two trials, the judge looked at what the evidence was at the time. And this case is somewhat unique because the recovering officer, Officer Wilkins, is deceased. And so the district court judge went on and said, well, the only thing you have is what was at the Superior Court trial. And we suggest that the judge shouldn't have looked at what the evidence it was at the time of the motion for new trial, and the judge shouldn't have restricted the analysis solely to what the testimony was in the Superior Court case. The judge
If the new trial were granted, there would be no conviction to introduce, correct?
Correct.
But there would be all of the same conduct that had led to the conviction could have been introduced by live testimony of police officers.
Well, the argument obviously would be, looking forward, if a new trial were granted, I think the defense attorney would argue that given the fact that the evidence was turned over so late, the Brady evidence was turned over so late, that the government should not be allowed to introduce the 404B testimony at all.
Well, the lateness is irrelevant once you've got a new trial. Now it's not late. Now it's months later.
But then the government would at the same time would have to re-argue that the 404B evidence is admissible. And the defense is now put in a position where it is having to bear the brunt of the government's lateness. And so, therefore, the trial judge at that point would have to decide whether it's, fair to allow the government to put this, limited testimony on when it is the government that put the defense in the position of not having the evidence in the first place when would have been useful.
I mean, all they did was, by making a mistake that causes a new trial at a later date, put you beyond the reach of the officer who recovered the license. He's dead. Isn't that the only consequence of the delay?
Right, exactly.
Right.
We are being...
And he could not identify... Well, do we know what... I thought we said he could not identify where the license was found.
He was not asked that by defense attorney.
Okay.
But the defense attorney argued in closing, and there was no objection, and the government didn't try to rebut in any way. He argued that the license was found with the drugs. There is also the affidavit from trial counsel from the Superior Court case that the license was with the drugs.
What? With the drugs? What do you mean by with the drugs? It was in the car, right?
It was his, I believe.
And the pictures don't show it with the drugs.
Right, because the pictures only show what was on top. I mean,
right.
Nobody, I think there was testimony that the officer who took the pictures did not disturb anything within the council, didn't move anything out and about.
So all we know is the license was in the car. We don't know where in the car.
Well, I think the defense attorney said it was with the drugs in the...
Right, the defense attorney said that, but I'm not sure there's any evidence.
To say it was in the car with the drugs may mean no more than at the same time as the drugs, correct?
Well, that, exactly, but I think we have to... We have to look at what the defense could have done at the time had it been turned over, and the defense at the time could have talked to Officer Wilkins, could have found out from Officer Wilkins, could have cross-examined Officer Wilkins on specifically where he recovered the license from. But that's, you know, it's lost now. The defense doesn't have that option.
Is that the nub of the argument?
Basically, it is. That
seemed to me, yeah, that seems to me the core.
That is the core of the argument, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. All right, well, you have a little time.
Unless there's further questions, no.
Let's hear from the government.
Morning. May it please the court, Jonathan Hooks on behalf of the United States. In this case, appellant has not met his burden to show that the license was material for three reasons. First, the license would not mitigate the overall effect and power of the Rule 404 evidence about a virtually identical incident that happened 2.5 weeks before the charged offense. Second, the Rule 404 evidence as presented through live testimony would have been more compelling than the limited brief proffer that appellant chose when given the opportunity at his actual trial. And third, as the district court noted during that hearing below on this, the evidence about the license was very limited and was equivocal at best.
The first and second points depend upon the assumption that the judge would admit the 404 evidence.
Well, Your Honor, at the...
Ms. Davis has just put on in the contest here.
Well, as Judge Hogan held below that he would admit it, and appellant conceded at the argument below that they were not advancing the argument that the Rule 404 would be excluded because of this license. They abandoned that argument during that hearing before the district court.
What did the judge say about that? Sorry, I forgot.
I'm sorry?
What did the judge say about the 404B?
That issue came up at the actual hearing. I can't. It's a 40-page transcript. I can't recall the exact page number, but the appellant abandoned that and said, we're not arguing that as a result of the license being discovered that the Rule 404 evidence wouldn't have come in. And there's no basis to think that the judge would have excluded. In fact, I believe Judge Hogan holds it would still have come in and that he can't assume it would not come in. And under the Brady standard, that's a determination as far as what would have happened, what the evidence would have been, by the district judge that's entitled to deference by this court under the abuse of discretion analysis, because the admission of that Rule 404 evidence is committed to the trial judge's discretion in the first instance. I should add, in the previous appeal, this court was presented the question of was that Rule 404 evidence admissible at all, and found it not to be a close question.
If the license had come in, it would have had some effect, no?
It would have had some minor effect, but the power...
Some minor effect. We know in the Superior Court case, that's from the affidavit in the record, that some of the jurors, after the acquittal, identified the license as one of the reasons for the acquittal in the other case, right?
That's correct, but...
So given that and given common sense, I think... We know it would have had some effect, maybe minor, but not zero. I think you started by saying it would not mitigate the effect of the overall evidence. Well, maybe a little bit at least.
Perhaps a little bit, but let me respond to that in two ways. One is the Superior Court jury was presented, this is an apples and oranges comparison to what would have happened in the district court. They were presented with a single incident, only the Mercedes incident, rather than the juxtaposition of these two incidents.
No, I know, but the question's how much of weight do you give to the Mercedes incident? And that depends a little bit on in figuring out what happened in the Mercedes incident. And whether the defendant was responsible, the license is of some relevance, at least the Superior Court jury so found.
No, and I didn't mean to suggest that it has no effect whatsoever, and if I did, I misspoke.
Given that it has some effect, some maybe minor effect, but some effect, the license, what about the fact that this was obviously a very close case because it was a hung jury the first time? Retrial, and doesn't that almost by definition mean that there was a potential effect?
Well, I don't agree with that premise, and for several reasons. First, the district court jury that convicted did so in the span of an afternoon. The record shows they're released to deliberate at 12:06 and come back later that day with a verdict, or at least a note that says they'll announce the verdict the following morning. To compare the results in the Superior Court jury, as I said, is an apples to oranges comparison, because that jury really...
The premise was the first district court trial. Am I right that the first district court trial ended in mistrial because of a hung jury?
That's correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And that should give the court no pause, because at a retrial where the evidence was presented through live testimony of the officers describing that stop, the jury would have focused its attention more on this previous incident. It would have been presented in more detail. It would have included details that were not in the proffer that were very damning. For instance, the fact that appellant was outside the car with his Mercedes car keys when he's arrested. The fact that appellant reached into the console, was observed by the officers reaching into the console, not in the proffer that was presented to that jury. And as that evidence was presented through live testimony, appellant preferred the proffer because it robbed that of the power on the jury to communicate, wait a second, the exact same thing happened 2.5 weeks before that he had 48 Ziplocs of crack cocaine in his own Mercedes that he owned, had his registration in the car, had a registration to a separate car, a Toyota, in there, and you're telling me 2.5 weeks later he stopped in a Ford Expedition with 18.8 grams of crack cocaine, both incidents in the same location on Livingston Road, both incidents with evidence of distribution also in the console. The power of that might be slightly diluted by being able to say, well, in one incident, wasn't there one officer who said there was a license in the car? But it wouldn't rob the evidence of the real power of the 404 evidence, which is that, look, lightning didn't strike twice. This is not a coincidence. It shows clearly that he knew about and intended to possess the drugs in that console. And I'd like to address briefly defense counsel.
Before you go on, you said the evidence about the driver's license was equivocal in any event, right?
That's correct.
I'm looking at Joint Appendix 25, the affidavit of Andrew Ferguson, staff attorney, Public Defender Service, paragraph 5. These photographs also included a picture of a valid D.C. driver's license of a man named Covey Cousin, that's who we're talking about, resting in the center console of the car that was alleged to be Mr. Pettiford's car. The driver's license was near the cocaine in the center console of the car.
Your Honor, what
appellant, part of that.
What appellant conceded at oral argument below was that statement is false. That statement in the affidavit is false. There was no photograph showing it in the car. There was no evidence whatsoever that the license was with the drugs in the console. And repeatedly, Judge Hogan criticized defense counsel for arguing that at the Superior Court trial, and ultimately appellant conceded when pressed by the district court that was not accurate. They would not be able to argue that. And that, again, is a finding of fact by the district court that is entitled to deference by this court.
Can you point me at that? I just don't recall it.
I'm sorry?
Can you point me at that ruling?
It's within the span of his, I believe we cite in our discussion of the findings of fact and conclusions of law in our brief, the particular page numbers. It's during that oral argument before Judge Hogan that he finds, and appellant concedes that, quote, the only evidence that would have come in was the one officer statement that the license was somewhere in the car. And Judge Hogan explicitly says they would not have been able to argue that it was with the drugs. And he even points to the fact that other officers, Officer Hopkins, the crime scene officer, Lieutenant Murphy, who was present for the search, neither one of them, or I should say both of them, testified they never saw that license in the car. And their version of events is actually buttressed by the fact that the crime scene officer took photos in the car, none of which show the license. He only took a photo of the license on a desk inside the 7th District Station. The fact that the license wasn't recovered as physical evidence, and the fact that they prepared property reports about what they seized from the car, none of which reflect the license. So, in fact, there's a very serious question as to whether or not the license was even in the car, or whether Officer Wilkins has perhaps had a failure of memory and thinks, well, if it's in the photographs, it must have been. But that would be the limit of what they'd be able to introduce, one officer having a vague recollection. Now, appellant argued in the opening argument that, well, the judge should have looked at what we could have done had this license been disclosed. But in fact, in this case, we know what they could have done. The license was produced on August 27, 2007, prior to the Superior Court trial. And that trial is continued. It ends up getting continued multiple times. And the defense in the Superior Court case, where the license is, if you will, most directly pertinent to that very case, they have 7 months to investigate. And the only thing they're able to come up with, the only evidence, is this one leading question to Officer Wilkins. Well, the license was somewhere in the car, wasn't it? They were unable to find anything else to support their theory that the license was in the car generally, or was with the drugs specifically. So to come before this court and say that you should assume or speculate that there's other evidence out there simply is not something that this court should engage in, and is really attempting to excuse their burden to prove materiality of the license.
This information, this Brady information, came to light shortly before trial, I think. Is that right?
It depends on what trial we're talking about. The district court, the arrests occur in April and May of 2006. Defendant pleads on July 17th, 2006, to the Superior Court case. Mm-hmm. And then we have the district court trials in September and November. He's convicted at the end of November 2006. After that, and at that time, no one in the prosecution office knows about the license, and there's been no allegation of any bad faith here. Later, in January of 2007, so after the conviction, Mr. Pettiford is allowed to withdraw his Superior Court plea, and the case is the Superior Court case is set for trial. So it's in August 2007 that, in response to a defense request, hey, are there any photographs, the Superior Court prosecutor requests, hey, crime scene, could you process your roll of film here and see what's on it? And that's when the photographs are discovered, April 27th, 2007, turned over to defense, and then there's a Superior Court trial in the spring of 2008. So the photographs are only discovered about 9 or 10 months after the conviction and
discovered. Discovered
by the prosecutor's office. Obviously, the government is conceding.
So they weren't in your files?
They were not in the government's files, but obviously under Brady.
I understand.
It encompasses.
Does the U.S. attorney in this district have an open file policy?
We do not, Your Honor.
Okay. Further questions?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would just briefly close by directing the court to how the reasonable probability standard has been articulated by the Supreme Court and quoted by this court, that it's not a reasonable possibility, as the Supreme Court said in Strickler. It's a reasonable probability. And what do we mean by that? We mean something that could reasonably be taken to put the whole case in a different light, or that would have resulted in a markedly weaker case for the prosecution. And that's the precise kind of analysis that Judge Hogan followed in assessing the evidence in this case. Yes, it might have some impact. It's not completely irrelevant, but it would have some minor impact on Rule 404 evidence, the overwhelming weight of which would still, 2.5 weeks later, have a powerful effect on the jury and result in the same verdict. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hooks.
Yes, in response to a couple of the arguments made by government counsel, I would first point out that no one conceded on the defense side that that portion of the affidavit from Mr. Ferguson was false when he stated that the drugs were found in the count, that the license was found in the counts with the drugs. What I did say is that from the pictures that I have seen, they did not show the license in the counsel. I don't know if I have seen everything that is there. Mr. Ferguson, though, was quite adamant in his belief that he saw a photograph of the license in the counsel, and that's a sworn affidavit by him, and we never conceded that that was false on anyone's part. In addition, we did not concede that the 404B evidence would be admissible if a new trial were granted. On page 29 of the hearing on the motion for new trial, we said that we are not addressing whether the 404B evidence is admissible at this time. We did not concede it was admissible. And I think government counsel misspoke about what was in the transcript in regard to that. Also, even though the picture...
But Judge Hogan did conclude, did he not, that the evidence would come in?
I don't think he concluded that it would come in. I don't think it was...
Let me see what I've got here, if I can get back to it.
I don't think it was...
It questions the strength of the 404B evidence, but I don't think it militates against its admission of its overall of its effect overall. That sounds like he's saying it would come in.
Yeah, but I mean, he also said it was material. But I think there was no argument on the admissibility of the 404B evidence. That would be something that would, I think, be raised if a motion for new trial were granted, just as if it would be argued later on, and Judge Hogan also agreed with this, it would be argued later on whether the fact of the acquittal would be brought before the jury. So I think these were issues that were, at least in the defense mind, were left open for to be addressed when when the new trial were came forth. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that the judge found this very disturbing. And the judge stated that they needed this evidence, and we have affidavits from both from the defense attorney and from the prosecutor that the fact that this license was found in the was found with the drugs or in the car with the drugs, that it had some bearing on what the on the decision to acquit, and I think we can't forget the impact of that evidence. It is not as light as what the government is saying it is. The judge made very clear they needed this evidence, and he also made very clear that letting the transcript of the plea come in was very damaging. And I think
the evidence of the other crime was very, or the other event was very strong, wasn't it? An officer observed him in a drug transaction.
Observed him doing something, yes.
Well, taking baggies out of his pants, exchanging for money, putting something in the car, was the sole user of that car, right? One arrested. So it was fairly powerful. You know, and then there's cocaine in the console with a couple hundred dollars in the console of that car.
Right.
All that still comes in, and that's very powerful. No?
Not as powerful as admitting guilt, I would suggest.
No, I agree with that, but it's still fairly powerful when the question is a couple weeks different, whether it's the same defendant doing the same thing. Right,
but what I think is kind of noteworthy about this case is that in the instant case, Mr. Pettiford is driving somebody else's car. He was not driving his car. So I think the argument would be there.
But all that goes to show is that the other case is even more powerful than this case.
No, I beg to differ. I think the argument.
I mean, I realize you, the Superior Court jury acquitted, but it was his car. It was his car in the other case, right?
Right, right. But just as you know, I mean, Mr. Pettiford argued that the car in the instant case, in this case, belonged to someone else. It could have been their drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it may well be that in the Superior Court case, Mr. I think it was Cousins was using Mr. Pettiford's car as well and had drugs in it. Mm-hmm. So it'd be sort of a like situation. And mm-hmm. That's something that, you know, the defense wasn't able to bring out.
Mm-hmm.
Another point I would like to make is that I think this court can consider why the prosecutor didn't produce the Brady evidence in the Superior Court case prior to the plea when they produced other discovery materials. If it had been just given to Mr. Pettiford in the Superior Court case before he pled guilty, it's very unlikely that he would have pled guilty. And I think that's something that this court can consider. And also the fact, and I believe I'm right on this, is it was the same prosecutor in the district court case as in the Superior Court case. And I think he had a duty to produce it in Superior Court as well as in District Court.
Well, that's a given, right? The government's conceded that it should have been produced. The only question here is the effect on the outcome.
Right.
Okay.
And so if there are no other questions, we would submit that that Mr. Pettiford is entitled to a new trial based on the Brady violation. And we cannot forget that he was acquitted of the Superior Court case, and that was very powerful evidence. And we have a sworn affidavit from Mr. Ferguson that the license was with the drugs, and no one has been able to dispute that. Thank
Can
you.
I ask you one question?
Yeah, sure.
You were the lawyer in Pettiford 1, right?
Or were yes, you? I was.
And when did you learn about the driver's license in relation to the appeal in Pettiford 1?
It was sometime during the course of the appeal, I believe. It was after, I'm trying to remember. It was after the notice of the appeal. It was in that case we argued that he was entitled to a new trial because of the withdrawing the guilty plea. But it was after both trials and after noting the appeal. But I don't remember exactly when.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
All right,
Davis.
Thank you.
Mr. Brooks, thank you. Case is submitted. Did you get a form? Oh, you're right. Ms. Davis, it occurs to me, I'm reminded that you were appointed by the court in this case, and we do appreciate your efforts. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Herb Titus, and we're representing Daniel Chapter 1 in this petition for review from a decision and an order of the Federal Trade Commission, and I have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. The FTC's case against Daniel Chapter 1 is simply this, that Daniel Chapter 1's cancer treatment claims involving 4 dietary supplements were deceptive solely because Daniel Chapter 1 failed to substantiate those claims by the kind of controlled clinical studies required by the FDA for pharmaceutical drugs. Now, in a last-ditch effort...
I thought it was pointed out that there's a similarity, that the FDA's requirements are a good deal more stringent.
It would be the same, Your Honor, because the witness upon which the FTC relied in this particular case, Dr. Dennis Miller, mm-hmm. stated specifically that the competent, reliable scientific evidence for any kind of cancer treatment claim, whether it's based upon a drug or whether it's a dietary supplement or herbal medicine. He said that it must meet the kind of scientific test that is applied by the FDA to pharmaceutical drugs. And that particular report, and I need to make 2 points about that, that particular report was the only evidence introduced by the FTC with regard to the competent and reliable scientific evidence that would standard that would govern the case. And the administrative law judge, as well as the commission itself on appeal, adopted that oncologist report for itself and endorsed that particular test as the test by which this particular claim in this case was to be measured. Now, it's important to note, and I hold up here page 38 from the FTC brief, where they attempt in a last-ditch effort to rescue this order by referring to what they say is extrinsic evidence to show what a reasonable consumer would have believed that the Daniel Chapter 1 representations were based upon the same kind of scientific testing as pharmaceutical drugs approved by the FDA. For the first time, Your Honors, they make a claim based upon consumer expectations. Now, if you go back and look at the administrative record, there's no evidence that the oncologist upon whom the Federal Trade Commission relied based their decision to require controlled clinical studies as the standard by which to measure Daniel Chapter 1's claims. They did not base that upon consumer expectations. As a matter of fact, if you look at that page 38, look at footnote 13. There's an attempt here by the FTC to anchor this claim that the reasonable consumer would think that any dietary supplement that is being promoted to fight cancer had to meet the FDA criteria. And look at the what they found in the record. They said, indeed, in describing BioShark, DCO's cancer newsletter expressly compared the product to a drug, stating scientists recognize the benefits of starving a tumor to limit its growth. They have been looking for a drug to patent that can do the same thing as shark cartilage. Well, that doesn't in any way indicate what consumer expectation has to do or that there is any notion that the test that the FDA requires for pharmaceutical drugs would be the one that reasonable consumers would expect with regard to dietary supplements. A second point, Your Honor. It was not until this brief was filed that our clients had any idea that the basis upon which the FTC was claiming that their cancer-fighting claims had to conform to the FDA standard. They did not know that that was based upon extrinsic evidence with regard to consumer expectations. There was nothing in the oncologist's expert report or in his testimony that had anything to do with consumer expectations. It all had to do with the FTC misusing its reasonable basis theory, not as a theory that governed consumer expectations, whether implied or expressed, but to use that reasonable basis theory to set a health policy, not one that protects consumers from deception. Now, there was no finding in this record that the Daniel Chapter 1 implied that its claims, that its dietary supplements fought cancer, were based upon controlled clinical studies. As a matter of fact, the FTC in their brief admits that the major reliance upon which they placed that claim was through individual testimonies, which the oncologist expert said.
You mean by individual testimony, you mean the testimonials from patients?
Yes, yeah. Yes, excuse me. And the oncologist expert said, well, that was no evidence at all. So you couldn't imply from what DCO had said about its cancer treatment claims that it was in any way based upon clinical tests of the kind that the FDA requires for pharmaceutical drugs. Another point, Your Honors, is that the FTC failed to produce any custom. I'm sorry,
Your Honor. Am I mistaken in thinking that at some point, whether it's in this brief, in their brief or in the record below, that the government suggests that the evidence that they're requiring of you is, in fact, short of what the FDA requires for approval of a drug?
Yes, Your Honor. For example, DCO introduced two experts, a naturopathic physician and an expert botanist who had expertise in the area of herbal medicine. Both of those witnesses testified that there was a reasonable basis for the cancer-fighting claims that were made by Daniel Chapter 1. The administrative law judge rejected that testimony on the ground that that was not controlled clinical studies.
But here's, that's not quite my question. Does not the government at some point say the controlled clinical studies that are being demanded by the ALJ and by the commission are something less than the FDA would demand to license a drug?
Your Honor, the only witness that the FTC put on was the oncologist.
Well, I'm not sure this is a fact question. I mean, it's a matter of public record and law as to what the FDA requires. Is it something more?
Well, all I'm suggesting to you, Your Honor, is they put that witness on. There was no other witness with regard to what was competent and reliable scientific evidence, just this one oncologist. And that oncologist, and you can see the report, Your Honor, in the appendix to this case. The full report is there. And before he examined the question with regard to the sufficiency of the DCO's representations, he laid out in great detail the controlled scientific evidence test that's applied by the FDA. I notice, Your Honor, my time is up if I'm going to reserve any time for rebuttal.
That's a difficult choice. You'll have to make it.
Well, I believe that what you will find in this record, Your Honor, is that in order to apply this standard, they had to ignore their limitations by authority with regard to protecting the reasonable consumer, and that, as a matter of fact, they act without authority. They acted contrary to the policy of the government stated in the Dietary Supplement and Health Education Act, and therefore acted completely ultra vires, and I believe that that alone is sufficient for the petition for review to be granted in this particular case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tice. Mr. Daly?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, John Daly for the Federal Trade Commission. Your Honor, in our view, this is a rather straightforward and very important case of false advertising. The Commission approached this case in conjunction, in accordance with the decades of advertising law, and found that these claims were deceptive. The reason for that was because they were unsubstantiated. Now, substantiation...
That only works if, as we were just discussing with counsel, there's an expectation underlying these claims that there must be some substantiation.
I think that's right, Your Honor. But that assumption, that premise, has been with the Commission and the courts for decades. Going back to Thompson Medical, a case nearly 25 years ago that this court upheld the Commission on, the Commission explained very clearly in that case why substantiation doctrine can be grounded in deception doctrine as well as unfairness doctrine. They pointed out that what the Commission knows from decades of working with advertising cases is that an objective product claim by itself necessarily conveys to consumers that the advertiser has a reasonable basis for that claim.
By an objective product claim, what do you exclude? I mean, if the claim is a bunch of testimonials saying, eating this stuff makes me feel like $1 million.
The important thing, Your Honor, is what the consumers take away from seeing those claims. Mm-hmm. Actually, the Commission
is that what you're trying to exclude? If the advertising were a bunch of testimonials saying, eating this product makes me feel like $1 million, I feel great. Doesn't make any cancer claim.
There are essentially two steps to the process that the Commission and the courts have been using for many years. Number one is to figure out what is the consumer taking away from this ad. Is the consumer taking away from this ad the message, this product will prevent or cure cancer? And if that is so, that's an objective product claim. Now, how the advertiser does that can be done in many ways. The courts have recognized for decades that an advertiser can do things other than simply make the product claim in express terms. It can imply it in many ways. And we have found that one of the most powerful ways that an advertiser can convey a claim is by presenting testimonialists, because consumer research shows that consumers will normally, in the absence of very strong qualifications, consumers will normally take the message that the testimonialists are providing typical results. Actually, the Commission, pretty much contemporaneously with this case, just last year, completed a rulemaking in which it revisited the entire testimonial and endorsement guide. And it found, on the basis of more recent research, that it's very powerful for consumers to be confronted with testimonialists who the testimonialists themselves undoubtedly believe they were cured. They, of course, don't really know it. But the important thing is the consumers will then take that as a typical result.
And what's the foundation for that?
As I said, the Commission is an expert agency that has
But did it do something to gather evidence to that effect?
I don't think they have to reinvent the wheel every time, Your Honor.
Well, if you say testimonials are particularly powerful,
yes.
Is it something that is based on survey evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And for example, in the rulemaking that was conducted just last year, in which the Commission revisited the issue, it talked about that sort of evidence. I mean, normally, Your Honor, if you look back even to Thompson Medical itself, the courts have taken as a given the reasonable substantiation doctrine. It's been with us for a long time. Counsel for Daniel Chapter 1 accuses us of coming up with new arguments on appeal. In fact, what we simply have done is, in response to their taking a broader look, is we stepped back, we thought for the benefit of the court, to talk about the origin of the doctrine. Now, it is true that what we wind up with is that we speak in shorthand, I think, nowadays. We say, yes, there's a substantiation doctrine. You have to have reasonable substantiation for any objective product claim. Now, to go back 25 years, where did that come from? Yes, that comes from our understanding of basic consumer perceptions. But that's a very important thing, Your Honor, because it shows the fundamental difference between the law enforcement mode that we act in and the regulatory mode that the FDA acts in. Now, we take it as our starting point, based on decades of knowledge of consumer perceptions, that consumers normally will assume a reasonable substantiation for the claim. And then we go on to figure out what is reasonable in a particular circumstance. But if there's particular evidence that a claim has been made so carefully that the consumers are informed of what the basis for it is, then things could be different. Now, Daniel Chapter 1 could have made a serious effort at that. They could have told their listeners and their readers on their website very clearly that we do not have the sort of scientific evidence for this for these products that is normally expected by the FDA and other regulators. They could have told their listeners very carefully that these are testimonials saying what they believe, but we do not have scientific proof for it. But quite to the contrary.
They could have said that.
Excuse me?
You say that would have been okay?
I'm saying that could have been a start. I will admit, Your Honor, we are skeptical at the FTC of qualifications because we know that consumers often take away a very strong message. What I am saying, Your Honor, is that this is not even that kind of difficult case because Daniel Chapter 1 did not make a serious effort at qualifying these claims. If you look at the actual claims that were made, they talk about BioShark stops tumor growth, 7-herb formula battles cancer, GDU digests the proteins in tumors. They make these statements flat out. And they even talk in the language of science, particularly on the website. They talk about BioShark stopping angiogenesis, the ability of tumors to propagate themselves by making new capillaries. They talk about the precise preparation methods they use in the herbs to maximize their photochemical potency in curing cancer. What happened here, Your Honors, is that Daniel Chapter 1, despite its religious basis, and we're not doubting that, But despite that, they were offering products to the public on a public website with occasional references to religion, but with a clear statement that these are products that would have these effects. And as I said, they even talked in the language of science. I think any reasonable consumer looking at this stuff would assume that, gosh, these people must have some basis for it. Now, what basis is that? That's a factual question. That's what we addressed in the proceeding. We had an expert witness who talked about what is normally considered appropriate in this circumstance. Now, that too goes back to the factors that the commission has looked to for the appropriate level of substantiation ever since the Pfizer and Thompson Medical cases 30 and 25 years ago. One of the important factors is what's considered normal in the industry. So yes, we looked to an expert witness, and yes, he said in this particular case, given the strength of these claims, I mean, these products were being sold as cancer cures. I think given that, it's perfectly reasonable for, based on the testimony of an expert witness, for us to conclude that in these kinds of claims must be supported by controlled clinical studies. And on the whole, the substantiation doctrine affords a lot of flexibility, but it depends on many factors, including what the claims are. I'd like to briefly mention, Your Honor, that we do think that it's clear that the Commission has jurisdiction in this case. The Congress is very careful in Section 4 of the FTC Act not to limit us to traditional profit-making corporations, but to include any kind of entity that serves to enhance the profit of itself or its members. We've talked at great length in the record about the evidence behind this. We don't mean to demean Mr. Fijo, but he obviously lives a perfectly comfortable lifestyle, and what he's doing is indistinguishable from what any other individually or closely held corporation could do. If you were to accept his arguments about being exempt from the AFTC Act, virtually any small business could say, gee, we believe in our product. We believe our product does a lot of good for people, and as long as they organize themselves the way that the Fijos and Daniel Chapter 1 have, with basically no books being kept, they could exempt themselves from not only the FTC's jurisdiction, but the taxation. We don't think that is possible.
You notified the Revenue Service?
That's not our concern, Your Honor. Your Honor, we do view this as a very important case. If you look at these ads, just the few snippets that we attached to the complaint, I think, are enough to show that these are ads that are offering people hope of cancer cures. Obviously, everyone wants hope. And there may be people who tried other methods, and perhaps these products may be harmless to most, although there's some evidence of some levels of harm. Our problem is not with the products. Our problem is not with the existence of alternate remedies and herbal medications being sold. Our problem is with the claims that were made. In our view, these claims were excessive and had to be substantiated.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Titus?
Your Honor, first of all, on the Thomas Medical case, if you look at the appendix to the record in that particular case of the commission, you will see that the reasonable basis theory would require the FTC to put into evidence either extrinsic or intrinsic evidence to show that the reasonable consumer would think that the particular standard that was being applied in this case was indeed the one that should measure these particular representations. They didn't put that evidence in. There was none such evidence. They put it in their brief after the record had already been made and prevented our clients from rebutting that. And if you notice that counsel on appeal, he does not refer to the controlled clinical studies. Instead, he hides behind the more generalized statement of reasonable basis. Now, in closing,
Thompson's a somewhat old case, isn't it?
The Thompson case, Your Honor?
When was that decided?
Oh, some time ago. But if you look at the
86. Now the FTC, maybe then too, I don't know, but they have this guidebook out, right?
Yeah.
Was that available when Thompson was decided?
I don't know if that guide was available at that time, but if you look at the FTC policy statement that was appended to the commission report that this court reviewed in the Thompson Medical case. You will see that it says standards for prior substantiation. They said whether or not a consumer has a reasonable expectation of a particular standard by which the health claim is being measured was either to examine what the manufacturer, the advertiser said, both implied and express, or introduce extrinsic evidence of what the reasonable consumer would have believed on the basis of those representations. May I suggest, Your Honor, that was not done in this case. As I pointed out to you, the first time that our clients had any idea that they were basing the controlled clinical studies test that they applied to their representations, had any idea that would rest upon consumer expectation, it was in this brief on page 38, not before, which meant that our clients had no opportunity in that administrative hearing to rebut the claim that a reasonable consumer would have thought that a cancer treatment claim for a dietary supplement had to meet the same strict scientific standard, so-called strict scientific standard, of the FDA. That just simply is not in the record, and for that reason, Your Honor, we believe that this petition should be granted and that the order be vacated and that the decision be reversed, and thereby to put a stop to the FTC's misuse of its power to establish an illegal, unconstitutional, and ill-conceived cancer treatment monopoly that is destructive of the health of the American people.
Thank you, Mr. Titus. Mr. Daly, thank you. Case is submitted.
I'll take it.
You.
Yes.